This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Stark, I'm joined here with Louis Marinelli. He's a recall candidate for the California gubernatorial race. I'm also joined here with co-host Jonathan Edwards. Great having you both on the show.
Thank you for the invitation. Glad to have a conversation.
Louis, you were involved with the Calexit movement as one of the original founders spearheading a 2014 campaign for California independence. You ran for California State Assembly as an independent, garnering about 6% of the vote. That's actually pretty decent for independent candidates. Most of them only get like 1%. That's actually pretty good. But this was in the San Diego metropolitan
district
region.
District 80, San Diego District 80 in the south.
So that's like Chula Vista?
Yeah, and then beyond.
So can you give our audience some background about yourself, and is the main reason you're running for governor primarily for the cause for California independence?
Well, sir, yeah, I mean, I am, and I consider myself an immigrant from New York State who moved to California. So I look at California in my eyes as a kind of a distinct society, which deserves to become an independent country. So I am jumping the gun there, and I already kind of look at California as an independent country, not on paper. And so from that context, I consider myself an immigrant to California from New York. I moved to California in 2011, I guess, after I had studied abroad in Russia. And lived there for several years, and then I decided to go back to Russia in 2016 as kind of a protest against American politics, California politics. I mean, I'm a candidate for a recall governor, as you mentioned, who's anti-Washington and anti-Sacramento. And that's one of the things that I think a lot of people don't realize about the Calexit movement is that we're not these cheerleaders for Sacramento. We are a cheerleader for California, but we have a lot of problems with the people who run California, who work in Sacramento. And so that's why we're not opposed to running in this governor recall race, because we think that we need to have a change of leadership in Sacramento. Now, we're not working on a change of leadership in Washington because we consider that, of course, a foreign capital. It's not our business to do regime change in a foreign country like the Americans like to do. And that's part of the reason that we'd like to get out of the United States, is that we can stop California from subsidizing and participating in America's foreign military adventures. So and to answer the last question, I would say that, you know, the reason that I'm running for governor is to promote the idea of Calexit, but it's not just a PR campaign. I mean, we're running this to win it. And if I'm elected, I will declare California to be an independent country. I will make that declaration unilaterally, and then I will put it in the hands of the legislature to affirm that declaration. And they will be faced with a question. They'll be faced with a decision to make. Are they going to affirm that decision that I make, that declaration that I make? Or are they going to turn around and tell their constituents across the state of California that they don't deserve to be an independent country? And I wouldn't like to be in their shoes if they were the ones who had to go back home and tell their constituents that they wouldn't affirm the Declaration of Independence because they think that Californians still need to bend the knee to Washington and that they don't deserve to be an independent country.
I mean, there's so many different issues. There's the issue of California being a donor state. So to make the case for, how would you make the case for independence to the audience? And what is your estimate of the degree of support for the cause of independence in California?
So the argument, like you're alluding to, is has a lot to do with the donor state situation, where California is paying, in layman's terms, more money to Washington than we get back from Washington in the form of federal funding. And so if we stop that by becoming an independent country, if we stop paying federal taxes to the IRS, to Washington, D.C., and we keep California's taxes in California, then that opens up so many opportunities for California to solve so many of its problems. Because frankly speaking, so many of our problems, as are so many problems in life, are directly related to or as a result of financial problems. And so if we can keep California's taxes in California and stop paying for America's foreign military ventures, and stop subsidizing the other states in this country, and we will have more money in our budget every year, in the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, that we can then use to solve California's problems, whether that be problems of infrastructure falling apart, whether it be problems of homelessness, whether it be problems of high taxes. I mean, we would actually have the ability to lower taxes while solving so many of California's problems that are the result of not having enough money to fund these areas, like education and healthcare and infrastructure, like I mentioned. So imagine a California where we had enough money to fully fund education, healthcare, rebuild our infrastructure, pay down our debt, lower taxes instead of raising taxes, and not be a part of America's foreign military adventures. That is the ideal. I mean, you might call me an idealist. That is the ideal. That is the goal that we are shooting for. That's why I believe that California should be an independent country, because I want California to be as good as can be. And I don't see that that's possible as long as we remain shackled by the statehood of our name. And so we want to make California an independent country and let her free, spread its wings, and find its place in the world as a country.
So there is like the pro-California message of California exceptionalism, and then there's the problem. It is currently under the current leadership in Sacramento. It is poorly run, and then all these issues like the housing crisis and homelessness and just countless issues that that people complain about. So you would say that you don't blame Californians, you blame Sacramento. Can you talk about the failure of the one-party state under the Democratic Party, and like what kind of political structure would you like to see, both of what kind of form of government under a hypothetical California nation, but even say California remains part of the United States, like what kind of political system would you like to see as far as parties go? Do you think alternative parties are the solutions, and just overall thoughts on the failure of one party rule in California?
Well, that brings up an entirely different angle on the previous point that we touched upon. And if we go back to revisit the question of, you know, why am I running for governor? Yes, it's to support the message and to promote the message of CalExit and to declare California an independent country. But it's also because, like I said before, I'm an anti-Sacramento candidate. And that allows me to make the following statement. If we look at the problems that we have in California, yes, they're a result of not having all of California's taxes in California, because we're subsidizing the other states. We're subsidizing the American budget, 13% of it, which means by default that we're funding and subsidizing the American military, which is why I keep bringing that up. Simply because it's not really a California value to spend so much money on weapons of war, especially when we have so many people at home in California without a home. And so I keep bringing up that military point because that's an important part of this equation, that we keep spending a lot of our taxes on the military. and America's foreign adventures and not taking care of the people of California. But by becoming an independent country, we stop doing that. Keep that money in California, and we can fix those problems. And that brings up this point. If we look at the problems that exist outside of the context of the donor state problem, there's been one party in control of Sacramento for decades, and that party is the Democratic Party. And so at this point in time, I don't see any way that anybody with a straight face would say that the problems that Californians face today are in any way the Republican problem, or any way a problem of another political party.
My observation with California's Democratic Party is that they use Californians as a source of donations. Like, they'll say, they'll tell California Democrats, you have to donate to us so we can win this race in Georgia to defeat the Republicans, but they've completely failed to invest in California, like in infrastructure or housing, or to focus on California issues. Basically, they're, the Democrats in California, they're entirely about using the state as a source of donations and for fundraisers for national campaigns.
Well, sure. I mean, if you want to talk about the National Democratic Party, which frankly speaking, I'm on the record calling it a criminal organization. I think that, yes, I mean, they take California for granted to such an extent that, you know, there's...
I don't even think Biden campaigned here. I think Hillary may have campaigned only once. Even Trump campaigned far more times in California.
Well, I think that Hillary campaigned here when she was threatened by Bernie Sanders winning California primary. I don't believe that she campaigned here in the general, but I could be wrong on that. But I know that there was a lot of hype about how Bernie Sanders was going to win, and I think he actually did, if I recall correctly, the California primary, the Democratic primary in California. And so I think that Hillary Clinton tried to at least try to reduce the margin, I think, that she came to California to some extent back in 2016. But yeah, the National Democratic Party, because there's this idea that California is so reliably blue that it's always going to vote for the Democrats, they don't come and campaign here and listen to the voters. And they, at the same time, like you're saying, they want the donations from California. The other problem is, and this is something that we can directly connect to Sacramento and the leadership in Sacramento, is the timing of our primary. I mean, we used to have a primary that was one of the last in the nation. And so states like Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, they would be voting in January and February. California would be voting in the primaries in June. By that time, the issue was settled. We already know, or we would already know, who the candidate was going to be in each party. So California's voices didn't matter. Now, recently they moved that up, but I would be a proponent of saying that California, as diverse as it is, with its massive population, its massive influence on the national economy, should have one of the first votes in the nation, and not simply relegate itself to being a member of Super Tuesday, or certainly not one of the last states. So that's a decision that the leaders, if you want to call them, in Sacramento have made about the timing of California's primary. And that makes it a situation where California's voices are not heard, and they don't play as big of a role as they should in determining who are the candidates who face each other in the general election.
And this election, there's actually three. So there's three candidates who support independence. Your campaign and Nicholas Wildstar, who we had on. He's running as a Republican, and there's another candidate, Michael Loebs, with the political party that's explicitly for independence, the California National Party. So you're running as an independent or declined to state.
Well, actually, no, I'm a registered Republican. I'll be registered.
Oh, so you're running as a Republican.
I'm running as a Republican because, well, let me give a couple of reasons for this. I mean, as you can tell by my previous statements, I'm not a big fan of the Democratic Party. I can't sell my soul to register as a Democrat, even though many of my beliefs are more in line with the Democratic Party. I just can't find it. I can't find the will power to have that name associated with my name, Democratic Party. I can't have the DEM next to my name. So I refuse. Just as I did in 2016 when I ran for independent. Why would somebody run as an independent in a state where you have basically progressive values. I mean, I was endorsed by the Birdiecrat movement. I basically have progressive values. Why would I register as a no party preference? Because I can't have that registration. I just can't do it for myself personally. And this time is no different. I cannot register as a Democrat. I won't sell my soul like that. So I'll register as a Republican because there are some values that I have that are in line with the Republican Party. And so this is something that I guess makes me, I guess, somewhat different from most politicians, but I think very similar to many Californians and many people around the country and the world even, is that, you know, I'm not an ideologue where I have a set of beliefs that matches one political party or another 100%. There are several things that I believe in that are in line with the Democratic platform, and several things that I believe in that are in line with the Republican platform, with the Libertarian platform, with the Green Party platform. So I'm a mixture. And so I chose the Republican Party because when it comes down to it, I am in opposition to the current administration, which is led by the Democratic Party.
Do you view the Republicans in California as a vehicle of breaking up the one-party monopoly? So what is your vision for a revitalized GOP? Like, where does it need to change? And can you kind of give an overview of where you stand on the major issues? Like, we can get into that more in detail with the platform.
Well, sure. I mean, ideally, if we could have a California where third parties could thrive, where we didn't have a two-party system, that would be the ideal that I think that we should move towards in California. And one way that we could do that is by, we require a complete reform of the system. So it's unlikely to happen under the current government and current political system under which we live. But ideally, we'd have some kind of a parliamentary system with proportional representation. Because right now we have a situation where even though, for example, we mentioned the Republican Party, I believe somewhere around 25 to 27% of Californians are registered Republicans. And yet the registered Republicans in California, they don't win statewide elections very often. And so they don't have that representation in government, even though they represent more than a quarter of the population of California.
You also have to factor in the decline to state, because so Democrats, they're a plurality, but they're not the majority if you factor in decline of state. So it's a winner take all.
Sure.
It's really one group that makes all the decisions.
The fastest growing group are among those who are decline of state and the no party preferences. And a lot of them are former Republicans who may, for the same reasons that I refuse to be registered as a Democrat, just don't want to be registered as a Republican, because the Republicans do have a lot of positions and do a lot of things that are justifiably causing many people to want to leave that party. So I'm not going to come on this show or any other show and go on the record and say I'm running as a Republican and I'm a proud Republican. I'm just, like I said, I'm running as a Republican because I am in opposition to the Democratic establishment in Sacramento.
Is there any particular issue that you would disagree with the Democratic Party if it wasn't for what was going on in California, in Sacramento?
Well, sure. I mean, I don't like the large presence of government in people's lives. Ideally,
right.
I think that we should move away from having this nanny state. So I'm a big proponent of, for example, parental rights. You know, I believe that parents, not the government, should be making decisions about how their children should be raised. And I think that if we look at the Democratic platform, a lot of the things that they support would include measures and laws that get the government involved in raising people's children. And I don't support that at all. So I would definitely depart from the Democratic Party in legislation or movements that involve this idea of, like, it takes a community to raise a child or something like that. I think it takes a family, you know, whether your family be a mom and a dad or two mothers or two fathers, it takes a family to raise a child. I have a child who was born 3 months ago. And I don't want the government telling me, you know, making decisions for me, how I should raise my child, and so on and so forth. So I definitely depart from the Democratic Party on when it comes to parental rights. I also depart from the Democratic Party when it comes to, related topic, when it comes to family planning. I know that there currently is a constitutional right to terminate a pregnancy. For many years, I believed that and supported that. I just didn't have that strong of an opinion one way or the other. But hey, a constitutional right is a constitutional right, and I believe in constitutional rights. So therefore, I was kind of sure there's a constitutional right to terminate a pregnancy, let a woman make a choice. But now, like I said, I have a child, and she's 3 months old, and I've watched her develop ever since she was 6 weeks old, when we could start getting pictures of her in ultrasound imaging. And having seen her develop from the age of 6 weeks old in 3D ultrasound imaging, I have now a moral objection to terminating a pregnancy. Now, does that mean I'm going to go out there and campaign on some pro-life, far-right Christian campaign against abortion? No. But I have a personal and moral obligation to say that I object personally to terminating a pregnancy. Having said that, like I said in the beginning, there is a constitutional right to do that. And so this campaign isn't about, you know, ending a woman's right to choose in California.
Would you say the Democratic Party, like it used to be more hospitable to people who kind of disagreed on those kind of issues, right? Like, you know, people who were maybe pro-life or maybe more religious. Have you noticed like there was ever any major point where that suddenly changed? Like, you know, there's kind of like that conspiracy theory, like, you know, the Great Awakening was basically a response to, you know, Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, I definitely have felt that with the Democratic Party, there is, they go beyond litmus tests, because when I was growing up and studying politics in school and listening to my family members talk about political issues as a child, I often heard of this expression, the litmus test. And right. I think that they go beyond that, though. The litmus test basically says, you know, are you pro-choice? Are you pro-life? Are you this or are you that? And that's just, you know, determining whether or not you support one issue or another. But the Democratic Party and the left in general, if you don't toe the line, that's the expression I would use for them. If you don't toe the line, then you're out. And not only are you out, but you're canceled, and they're going to go after you, and they're going to harass you, and they're going to make you regret the fact that you dared not toe the line. And that's, you know, goes into why I refuse to be a part of that. I can't, even though I share some of the basic tenets of the Democratic platform, why I can't find the willpower to associate myself with it by registering that way.
It used to be more about voting Democrat about economic issues, and then basically being a Democrat meant that you were for a social safety net, and then you were maybe tolerant of gay people. That's pretty simple, but this is just my opinion, but what John said is like the Great Awakening has become utterly insane, and then just all this cancel culture, and then this is kind of relevant to Colexit, because it's sort of become the new culture war. A lot of red states are like pushing to ban things like critical race theory. And Florida with Ron DeSantis, he's proposing some bill on tech censorship, but I've heard a critique of this bill that it does more to protect politicians than just average citizens on social media. What are your overall thoughts on those kind of issues in general, including tech censorship, cancel culture, and like the culture war over woke education? And if governor, how would you deal with those particular issues as far as your statements, but also as far as legislation goes?
Well, I think that one of the areas where I demonstrate, where I'm in line with progressive values is the fact that I used to be a card-holding member of the ACLU. And I say used to be simply because I don't live in the United States right now, where I've been able to renew my membership by mail. So, but I am a proud member of the ACLU. And when I return to California, I'll renew my membership and pay the past due fees. But the reason I joined them, not that I agree with everything that the ACLU does, but sometimes, and unfortunately not all the time, sometimes they take some pretty principled stances on some issues that are for the freedom of speech. And I am a major proponent of the freedom of speech. And I don't think that the government should be involved in stifling free speech. And so I would be a proponent of advocating for free speech, and also in opposition to any kind of, you were mentioning tech censorship. I think that we should make sure that people's voices are heard and that they have an opportunity to be heard. And I think that we need to, as a society, recognize that platforms such as Facebook and Twitter and Instagram are the public square of the 21st century. Whereas, you know, a couple of hundred years ago and about 100 years ago, you know, public square meant, you know, more literally speaking, the public square outside. But we now communicate mainly through our technology, through our phones, on these platforms of social media. And so I think that we need, as a society, to recognize them as the public square. And then that would, by default, mean that we need to extend the First Amendment rights to that public square and protect them vigorously. Because a lot of people may argue that you have the First Amendment right on Facebook and so on and so forth. But Facebook has the ability to delete posts or to punitively suspend your account for certain content that they find to be in violation of the terms of service. Well, the Bill of Rights isn't a terms of service. I mean, we have the right to free speech. In some very limited circumstances can that be restricted when it poses direct harm or a threat of direct imminent harm to other people, such as yelling fire in a crowded theater. The threshold for violating the Facebook and Twitter terms of service and other social media terms of service is much lower than that. And so by that...
The thing about their terms of service is when it comes to the law, there's like a clear legal definition of what's legal and what's not, but it's very iffy, the definition, and a lot of it's, there's these different algorithms where a moderator on Facebook might decide that they personally dislike something and suspend someone, but there's basically very little transparency and a very clear definition of what they consider a violation of their...
Oh, sure, and they're changing their terms of service all the time. And, you know, to meet whatever needs that they have of the day. Whereas the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, has been remained largely untouched since it's been written. So you're absolutely right there. I mean, I would like to see, at a societal level, a recognition of the fact that the Internet is now the public square of the 21st century. And people have, or ought to have, the same First Amendment rights that they have outside in the physical public square, that they should have those in the Internet as well.
Is there any particular piece of legislation or, you know, type of thing that you would propose that would solve it? I remember a long time ago there was that, you know, that Shall Not Censor bill. I think it was you know, proposed by some, you know, like Republican or right winger. It was trending on Twitter, I think, for a while, but it was like, if, you know, a platform has a certain number of people, then, like, you know, then they can't, you know, censor people for their political views.
Well, I mean, I can't refer to a specific piece of legislation that I would support on that topic, but if I can put it this way, I mean, if there's legislation proposed that supports free speech and limits censorship, especially by the government, then I will support that as governor. I will find legislation that protects the right of people to voice their opinions on the Internet and not be censored or deleted, canceled, or suspended by private corporations and or the government.
As far as jobs and economy go, would you support like a specialized job program that would pair people up with jobs that they're most compatible with on a personal basis? So what is your overall economic proposal as far as jobs go? And then also, do you support some kind of a basic income?
Sure. Well, I guess I have multiple levels of here of how I approach this. So some people might, you know, say, you know, trickle down economy, trickle up economy, so on and so forth. I think that, first of all, the biggest problem that we have right now is the exodus of Californians and their businesses from California. And so I think that we need to, first and foremost, address that. We need to investigate and come down to a decision about, I mean, I guess we could guess, we can understand, I think we know what that is, but let's just officially settle the issue and investigate what is causing people to leave California in such numbers as they are? What is causing the exodus of businesses, small businesses from California into other states? And like I said, we can guess about that. We can discuss that between individuals. But until we have official report that says, you know, some kind of a government report that says, this is why Californians are leaving, this is why their businesses are moving to other states, then we can't address the issue. So I would like to do something along those lines to get a reliable answer as to why there are so many people who want to pick up and leave California and take their businesses with them. And then we can address that problem, whatever that is, and reverse course on that topic.
There's not even agreed upon narrative, because some people are saying it's mostly people leaving because of poverty who are lower income, and then some people are saying that, I've seen various reports, but then some people are saying that high taxes are driving out people who are well
and
off.
I think, and I'm pretty sure it's probably a mixture of all of the above.
Yeah, probably a combination of both.
Let's get an answer as to say, what are the major driving forces that are driving Californians to leave California and take their businesses with them? And then let's change that. Whatever that is, whatever the it is, let's do the opposite, because we want to have people come back to California. We want to have to bring their businesses back to California. On the same hand, we want to, you know, say that with some measure of restraint, because we don't want to have overpopulation in California. We have resources that we need to consider in California. So we don't want to have, you know, 240 million Americans come into California because of how great it is. We wouldn't have enough water for them. We wouldn't have space. We have to talk about, you know, a housing crisis we have now. What kind of housing crisis would we have then? So, of course, we want to bring back Californians. We want Californians to come back to California. We want to have them bring back their businesses. But we don't want to have everybody come to California. So I would say we want to find out what is the it that's driving people to leave California, reverse course on that, and encourage them to return to California. That would be the number one issue I have in terms of getting our economy back, because people need jobs. And when these companies, whether they be large or small, cross the border into other American states, Californians lose jobs. And then, like you mentioned, you know, they may lose their source of income, and they may fall into poverty, which then causes them to want to leave California. So I think it has a ripple effect on several issues in California. And if we can just find out what is the it and reverse course on that, we can bring people back to California, bring California businesses back to California, and give people back their jobs, and hopefully spur economic growth.
Another thing about the exodus is it's kind of a safety valve. So if people are displeased about California politics, they'll just leave rather than pushing for positive change. Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a problem, and the leadership has failed to provide a decent quality of life to retain those residents. With the sort of Calexit movement, there's a perception in California that Trump is very much opposed to immigrants. With a hypothetical Calexit, do you support like a more welcoming stance as far as immigration goes, or do you think there is an ecological carrying capacity? How many people California could accommodate? So like right now, actually it did decline a bit because of the exodus, so it's slightly under 40 million. But as far as hypothetical immigration policy goes, do you think there is a cap of how many people California could accommodate due to the issues like water?
Well, of course. I mean, when you look at the situation, we do as a species, if you look at an abstract level, human beings are a species on the planet. And just like any other species, we have carrying capacities in particular habitats. So California, if we look at it as a habitat, has a carrying capacity. Now, I'm not prepared to say what that carrying capacity is right now, but we do need to take into consideration the fact that we just can't have, you know, all of the country living in California. That's what I was referring to earlier. So we do have some kind of carrying capacity, what our resources would allow us to support. When it comes to immigration, if you're referring to immigrants from other countries or from other states, I believe in a policy for California to establish an immigration policy that would allow immigrants to come to California. I am the author, or I guess you could say was the author, of a 15-page California immigration reform ballot measure back in 2015, which would have created a government agency in Sacramento to offer legal status to those who are undocumented in California so that they could work, pay taxes, thereby contributing to our economy and being able to support themselves to a greater extent so that it would be less reliant on government programs and assistance. And so as an abstract answer, I would say that I support allowing immigrants and those who wish to make California their home to come to California if they are going to make it their home. And in that context, I mean, not just come to California and not contribute to society. I believe in the fact that if you're going to come to a new place and make it your home, that you should contribute something of value to the new community in which you want to be a part of. I mean, I do that. I mean, as you know, I live in Russia now as an immigrant, as a foreigner, and I don't just come here and wave my American flag and be an American here. I try to assimilate into the community, and I try to contribute something of value by teaching children English with a Native American accent, and so they can grow up and be successful in their lives, because English is such an important language around the world that learning at a young age in a foreign country gives you a benefit in your resume and in your pursuit of a career. So I like to think of the fact that I come to Russia and live here and contribute something of value to Russian society. I think that when immigrants come to any country, that should be the case. And I would support that same idea for immigrants coming to California.
This is also relevant to the kind of population issue, but there is like a massive housing shortage and there's a homeless crisis. But even for people, you see people making like $250,000 a year, even those people are leaving because real estate is, they can get a lot more for their money in other parts of the country. What is your thoughts on the overall housing crisis? And do you see it as an issue primarily of zoning?
I think that we need to, I think a lot of people think when they come to California that they're going to be able to live on the beach. I think that there's this misconception that when people imagine California in their mind, that the only thing that they see, unfortunately, is Santa Monica, San Diego, Malibu, San Francisco. And those are the images that people have in their minds when they think of California. So when people move to California, I think that they come here with this misconception that they're going to be living on the beach. Well, there's more to California than the beach, than the shore. And so I think that what I would support is an initiative to encourage Californians and people who move to California to settle in cities more inland and develop those local economies and bring jobs and businesses to those locations so that it's not a rush for the shore. And in that context, I think that we could do a lot in terms of the housing problem. I think that there's a lot of demand for housing in certain localities, and when you have a greater demand, the prices are higher. I also think, we know that there's a lot of problems with just simply the construction of affordable housing, and the problem that I see with that is mostly a government problem with their regulations and policies and laws regarding the construction of new housing and affordable housing make it too costly and too difficult to do so. And I think that government should get out of the way that more affordable housing can be constructed. We need to get, for example, sorry to say, the environmentalists need to get out of the way, because people need to get off the streets and into homes if they want to. And I would support, as governor, plans to reduce regulations and to make it easier and cheaper to build more housing.
By the environmental issue, are you talking about, do you make the distinction between like sprawl versus infill development?
Well, by that I mean that there are a lot of special interest groups in California, and one of the most powerful ones are the environmentalists. And so, I mean, sure, I'm going to be painting a target on my back now from the environmentalists by calling them out and criticizing them. But sometimes I think that, you know, people in these special interest groups lose touch, lose a view of the larger picture. And so it's great, of course, to care about the environment. I care about the environment. It's great to want to, you know, have clean air and reduce the deforestation and to prevent a certain kind of NIMBYs to be constructed in certain neighborhoods and so on and so forth. But at the same time, we also have to balance with the simple fact of the matter is that there are homeless people on the streets, and we need to do something about that. So let's balance it. Let's do something in moderation. Let's find a compromise, and not just like we were talking about earlier, where there's this toe-the-line mentality on the left, where I'm afraid to say that these environmentalists sometimes they don't allow for compromise because it's all or nothing. And if it's nothing, they're going to go after you. So I think that we need to end that type of mentality so that progress can be made.
Are there any other platform issues, political issues, or policy issues that you want to mention that we didn't touch upon?
Well, sure. I mean, we're talking about policy issues. I think that one thing that's being discussed right now is the current governor's plan to extend kindergarten to four-year-olds. He's calling it transitional kindergarten, I believe. And I don't think that goes far enough. As governor, I would pursue legislation to create a universal pre-K system that allows children from as young as 3 to go to kindergarten. And I say that as a kindergarten teacher. I'm a kindergarten teacher, and I have seen firsthand how much of a benefit it is for children at a young age, as young as possible, to start attending kindergarten. It allows them to learn how to socialize with other children of their age, and that's an important benefit for their development. In fact, in my kindergarten where I work, there are sometimes children as young as 2 there, and they're already exposed to activities that allow them to develop their minds and their motor skills and their social skills. And I think that's wonderful. And it's a shame that in the United States and in California that, you know, kindergarten starts at 5. You know, so I think that 4 is a step in the right direction, but doesn't go far enough. So one thing that I would do, where I kind of make a distinction between myself and Mr. Newsom, is that I would go further, say that we need to have kindergarten from the age of 3. And we also need to support families with newborn children. And one way that I would do that would be to extend maternity leave in California to provide and guarantee 1 year of paid maternity leave for all mothers who go on maternity leave and 3 years of protection from termination from their job while they're on maternity leave. And that will create a situation that looks like this. You give birth to a child in California. You go on maternity leave. Your job is protected for 3 years, the first year of which you are paid for your leave. And then after 3 years, you send your kid to kindergarten and you can return to work. That's the type of environment that I'd like to create in California for families and for children so that we can have a situation where you can have a family in California and not worry about going back to work, not worrying about who's going to take care of your children when you go back to work, and not worrying about sending your kids to school unprepared for the academic rigor that they're going to be facing in schools and in universities simply because they didn't start at a young enough age.
I mean, another issue that's relevant to this is, like, with property taxes, like, families who are first-time buyers, they end up paying a lot in property taxes. So, like, the way property taxation works is, new-time buyers end up paying the most. Would you support property tax relief for first-time buyers, taking into account that it adds a greater strain on families?
Okay, so I think that if this kind of goes back into what I was talking about before, where we're trying to encourage people to come back to California, and yes, if as a method of encouraging Californians to return to California, we could provide some kind of relief to get them back into their homes or allow them to buy their first home. Like we were talking about, some of the reasons why Californians may be leaving California to begin with is because they can take their money and buy more land, more space, and more rooms in their house in other states than they can in California. So yes, if we could devise a plan that would provide some tax relief or perhaps some other benefits in relation with and together with that tax relief to encourage people to be able to return to California, and if they're still in California, to buy their own home. And that would be a great plan, because we want to have people in their own homes. We want to encourage home ownership. And I think that that could go a long way to establishing more permanent roots in California, so that people don't want to leave to further states because they have their roots in California. Whereas if they're renting a home, it's much easier to pack up your bags and move somewhere, especially with the lure of being able to potentially buy a home someday down the road in another state when they may think that it's impossible to do so in California.
Not to digress, but do you have any views on, say, higher education or like the student loan crisis?
Yes, of course. And this goes back to what we were kind of talking about in the beginning of the conversation, because I take the position that higher education should be paid for by taxpayer funds in such a way that when you finish high school and go to college or university or institute, that you don't pay tuition or fees. You just go there as you go to high school, you know. So we pay for high school with our taxes. I think that our public universities, colleges, and institutes of higher education should be also taxpayer funded. And if we were an independent country, to go back to that topic, we would be able to fully fund those public schools without raising taxes, simply by keeping California's taxes in California. I believe there was a report a number of years ago, not too long ago, from the California State Senate, that said that we would be able to pay for all of California's state universities and colleges to make them tuition and free. And I think the price tag was under $5 billion. It might have even been under $3 billion. I don't recall at the moment. But let's just say under $5 billion. Sounds like a hefty price tag. But when California is losing tens to hundreds of billions of dollars every year to other states in this country through the IRS, by keeping that money in California, we have that money and more, the rest of which we could spend on things like providing a public option, public health care option, so that all Californians have at least their basic health care needs covered, while we also at the same time would encourage the purchase of private health care plans to provide more extensive coverage for those who want it. But I believe that everybody should have at least the basic health care needs covered, and that should also be provided for through our taxes, something that we could fully pay for if we keep California's taxes in California.
Can you talk about the California embassy in Russia? I mean, this is purely more about California culture, but some of the attacks by the media have been pretty vicious. I'd say it's hypocritical too, because these establishment Democrats are the same people who talk about tolerance of other cultures, and they've been pretty nasty about attacks, personal attacks by living in Russia. But can you talk about the cultural embassy that you helped set up?
Well, sure. I mean, if we had a cultural embassy in Toronto or Ottawa, Canada, you know, Winnipeg or Vancouver, or even if it was in Paris, France, I mean, I don't think there'd be much media coverage of the issue. The fact of the matter is that, you know, when Trump was elected, there was this anti-Russian hysteria in the country. And as a result of that, the fact that I was in Russia, the media didn't care about that when I was in Russia before Trump was elected. I mean, I went to Russia in September of 2016 as the president of Yes California. And we attended a conference, the Dialogue of Nation conference, that month. And the media didn't have that same anti-Russian hysteria. It wasn't until after Donald Trump was elected, and that they had to justify that by saying, well, Russia must have helped, that all of a sudden the anti-Russian hysteria began. And then therefore, by extension, the anti-Russian hysteria began in relation to the CalExit campaign, because certainly California wouldn't want to secede unless Russia was behind it. Certainly Donald Trump wouldn't have won unless Russia was behind it. But Russia seems to be like the whipping boy, where whenever America has a problem, or at least from the Democratic point of view, whenever America has a problem that they can't solve or understand, it must be the Russians. I mean, this isn't something new. I mean, we had the Red Scare back in the 50s with all of the McCarthyism and so on and so forth. So the American society as a whole has a history of blaming the Russians whenever there's a problem or something that they're scared of or they don't understand. And we were just living through the most recent version of that after Donald Trump was elected. I think it's to some extent subsided now as we've become more aware of what actually transpired in the 2016 election, in that Russia, you know, certainly had some involvement in interfering or attempts to interfere in the election, but Donald Trump won fairly. And so I think that a lot of that stuff has gone away, but there are still some so-called journalists out there who, in violation of the code of ethics of the journalists abide by, you continue to spread falsehoods and inaccurate information and refuse to correct wrongly published information. So we're going to deal with that, but it's no big problem, because the fact of the matter is that the culture center in Moscow that we have does good work. And as the person who's in charge of that culture center in Moscow, we have had exhibits there where we've shown Russians who have visited aspects of California's history and culture. We've had an exhibit on Harvey Milk in Moscow, a city which bans gay pride parades. We had an exhibit on Harvey Milk. I think that's a beautiful story. And yet, that's not the story that the media writes, because that's not the message that they want to send. The message that they want to send is that, for example, the leader of Calexit lives in Russia, he works for Vladimir Putin, and that's why there's this movement for Calexit. It's not that Californians are interested in it. It's that the Russians are behind it. And so that's just kind of, I think, what we're dealing with, and we're going to continue to deal with. And we're prepared to deal with it. And that's why, for example, I make no attempt to hide the fact. I'm very open about the fact that I am in Moscow right now talking to you. I was in Moscow yesterday when I was talking with ABC News in the Bay Area.
I saw that interview tomorrow. And the point you made in response to the journalist from ABC is you said that there have been many people who have been ambassadors and they've gone on to higher office. So running for office, it's complete 100% legitimate under the law, but I got the impression that she was like personally smearing you for that.
Well, I wouldn't say that she was smearing. I think it's this. I mean, I think it's a somewhat of a fair question. And then here's the caveat. Once you hear the answer, you should be okay then with the answer, because the answer is this. With that answer yesterday, what I wanted to do was establish the fact that there are many people in many Californians, many Americans, who have gone overseas for extended periods of time and then returned home and run for office. You don't lose residency simply because you went to go live in a foreign country for a period of time. And I'm a representative of the Independent Republic of California in Moscow. We've been received here. We have a location here, a physical location here, where we have an office that was provided to us. So in that context, I consider myself, and the members of our campaign consider me, a representative of our movement to a foreign country. And in that context, I say that I'm not a resident of Russia or a citizen of Russia, but I am a resident of California. I am registered to vote in California. I'm an American citizen. I do not have any felonies really regarding financial crimes and embezzlement. And I haven't already served as two I haven't already served two terms as governor of California. And if you haven't caught on by now, I've just listed the four requirements for being elected governor. One, American citizen. Two, registered to vote in the state of California and eligible to vote in that election. Three, no financial felonies such as embezzlement. Number four, haven't already served two terms since 1990. I meet all four of those requirements, and that's why my campaign for governor, although I currently am located in Russia, is legal and will go on.
Lewis, is there anything else you'd like to add about your campaign, and do you have do you want to plug your campaign site?
Well, sure. People can visit my campaign site by going to calexatgovernor.com, calexatgovernor.com. There they will read about the campaign for California independence. They will also have some text there about my background, also some text there about some of the beliefs that I have on a host of issues, some things of which we've already talked about, such as maternity leave and parental rights, but also I have positions and strong beliefs on police reform and on things like the minimum wage, water and energy, and so on and so forth. So people will be able to see what I believe on some other issues in addition to CalExit. Because when it comes down to it, I mean, if I say that I'm going to make California an independent country as governor, well, there's going to be a lot more to do as governor than just declare California an independent country. So I think that the people have a right to know what I believe on a host of other issues. So that information is there at calexitgovernor.com. And I would also remind the listeners that this is an important distinction that I like to make about this election. When we have an election in America, it's typically between people who are asking you to vote for them to serve their personal ambition. You know, for example, Donald Trump had a personal ambition. He wanted to be president. Barack Obama was a community organizer and then a senator. He had a personal ambition to be president. He asked you to vote for him. And Donald Trump asked you to vote for him. I'm not asking people to vote for Louis Marinelli. I'm asking for people to vote for an idea, to vote to realize their own dream, because there are many people in California who have dreamt about the idea that California could become its own independent country. There's not a lot of debate in California, from what I've seen, about whether or not California could become its own country, whether or not we have what it takes. Most of the debate is on whether or not we should. I, of course, take the position that California should, and a lot of people share that opinion with me. And so I'm asking for Californians to vote for an idea. The idea is California independence, to realize their own dreams, that they believe that California should become an independent country. I'm just the medium through which they will be able to cast their vote. The first time in history, Californians will have a chance to vote to become an independent country. They have never had a chance, never had a referendum or an election where their vote represented a vote in support of independence. Until now. I'm not asking people to vote for me personally. I'm asking for people to vote for an idea and to help realize their own dreams. And I think that that's an important distinction that I make, because a lot of people, frankly speaking, they may not know me personally. They may say, who's Louis Marinelli? They may not, and frankly speaking, those who do know me may not like me. And they may not want to vote for me on that basis. But they still support the idea of California becoming an independent country. So whether or not you know me or you know me and you don't like me, I represent an idea, and I'm asking people to vote for that idea, to realize their own dreams, and lastly, to vote for themselves, because through independence, we will improve the lives of every Californian. And so this is a unique opportunity to actually vote in such a way to personally benefit from the results of that election.
That was Louis Marinelli running for California governor. Thanks for being on, and also thanks, Jonathan Edwards.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me on the show. Thanks so much for the opportunity to have the conversation.